And welcome back, everybody. We are talking with Neil Kramer about tribal identity, race, and the connection to our history, our ancestors, our past, but also the land that we find ourselves on and in. And I wanted to kind of just continue the conversation here, Neil, and get deeper into this and talk about some of the problems that we do face today with consideration to what we've talked about so far. We have, of course, multiculturalism. We have migration through warfare and in some cases seeking better prospects elsewhere. The world is in upheaval in that regard with wars and everything else. And unfortunately, young people that haven't awakened to their history and maybe who they are, their ancestor yet, tend to, you know, they tend to get with whom they find around them. That's fine for them. But in most cases, that's kind of just how it goes. And there's a tremendous pressure on countries like Britain and Sweden now too, but most of the Western world is like that. Europe, as we have known it, is something that the empire, and this is how I see it anyway, the empires is want to try to change that. We even have the distinct words of someone like Kudenhof Kalerge, the guy who gave the ideological spark of the European Union, talked very distinctly about this, about how there absolutely could not be a pure race in Europe. It had to be mongrelized. That's his words. He said that. So how do you view those things? And how do you view things like space and the access to geography, how the empire is seeking to change and uproot these things? How do we fight against that? How do we make sure that we don't fall into the trap that they've set for us here, do you think?
I think it's significant for us to understand why they're doing that, which takes us to a comment we made earlier, which is to say that if I was sat around a table with my imperial chums and they said, right, evil agent Kramer, what can you bring to the table to slow down the evolution of these human beings? As we said earlier, I'd say, well, the tribal, racial, cultural identity must be eliminated. And so the most effective way of doing that is through mixing everybody unmindfully, because there's always a percentage of happy migrations, of course, that keep everything spicy and cool. But when it's done unmindfully in the wrong proportions, it goes way, way, way off target. So I'd say, number one, I'd say you need to have nobody allowed to celebrate and embrace their own cultural identity, human cultural identity, not imperial. That's the first thing. But the second and most important thing would be to have an enormous population problem. And that's a bit of a double-edged sword, that, because you see these headlines, don't you, on alternative websites that are very sensitive about population reduction and stuff.
Mm, yeah, I've been thinking about that a lot, actually, recently too. But yeah, go ahead, Neil.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you, sometimes I dream about a giant asteroid or whatever coming and just smashing into the earth and wiping everybody out. And how wonderful that would be.
Yeah. I know.
It would be a lovely thing just to kind of start fresh and have another go, because we've learned some good stuff, and that gets saved in the Akashic record in the cloud, if you like. So yeah, all the good bits get saved and wipe out all the rubbish stuff and start again. Because I do think that the situation is not really backwards engineerable, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So there's two sides to this. One is that moving around the world, as I have done, and I know you've been traveling in recent years in your own professional and personal life too, you take special note of what works in communities and what doesn't. And the most significant thing that I've learned is that small works best, right? Small towns, small cities, small social circles, small events, small everything works really, really well. Mm. And smallness in that sense means sustainability, and it's within context. So small might be 50 people or it might be 50,000 people. It depends on the context or whatever. Localization is good, right? So local power structures are good. So here, I live on the Oregon coast now. So I used to live in Portland, and we moved to a coastal community, and there's many, many of them. They stretch really from San Diego right up to Canada. And there's tons of these beautiful little villages up and down the Californian, Oregon, and Washington coast. And I'm in one of them. And it's really lovely. And there's only about 1,000 people in my community. And it works pretty well. There's not really any problems. And people know each other and talk to each other, look out for each other. We know each other's names. Somebody invited me to speak at the Bloody Church, and I wish I did so very happily, and gave a great talk about Christian mysticism, you see, because it was a Christian place. So I tried to be respectful, but also authentic, you know. And it was great. And being involved at a social level and at a spiritual level, being involved in nature, learning from people who have lived here for a long time respectfully what this place is about and how it functions and what animals are here. And we had like a mountain lion wandering around the streets the other day, which is, I was very excited nice. By that. Yeah. Yeah. And we have bears and wolves even, all kinds of wonderful things and all that stuff. And I've noticed that that's really pretty good. If there was an immense problem, the last place you want to be really is in a city, because there's no community. You have lots of networks of people who have certain connections, but that's not a community. As my friend Niles pointed out to me recently, when people talk about communities, they're not really usually doing that at all. They're talking about networks of people and professional things and things like that. And that's different to a community. A community is where there's always some sort of involvement personally. And that's when you have that. So it's made me understand that if this community was to go off track, the number one way you do it is by having too many people here. And that slowly, I'm sad to say, started to happen in Portland, whereas they've got this new system. I think it's called Smart Build or Smart Live or something like that.
Of course.
Where they're trying to squash more people in smaller and smaller places.
Yeah.
So instead of it supporting its natural, sustainable habitat and inhabitants and terrain, it's being slowly eroded that. And the quality of things is slowly degenerating. Mm-hmm. Now, it might take 25 years, that, so I might not care personally. But obviously, I'm taking the long view and thinking, I've seen that happen to other places. I saw that happen to Manchester 30 years ago, and I've seen it secondhand happen to Seattle as well, which is still a brilliant city.
Yeah.
But it's grown beyond its bounds, and that affects the quality of life for everybody. So population is a massive, massive issue. I'll give you an example. The sustainable population in Britain, I think, is about 20 million people. Currently, there's 67 million people living in England.
Yeah.
In Britain, I beg your pardon. Ugh. So that 67 million are totally and utterly dependent on empire for daily resources.
Yeah.
If that cut off and it was returned to its state as an island 500 years ago, you'd have an instant die-off of tens of millions of people because it cannot support them. So if you go around London or whatever, every single person I've ever known who's been to London in the last 5 years has said, well, I didn't see many English people, number one. And number two, it was difficult to move around it because everything was so jammed in and so cram-packed. It was difficult to actually navigate around the place. And the infrastructure is starting to collapse. So there isn't enough resources and there isn't enough skills and there isn't enough human labor to actually upkeep that level of population. So I think that's an enormous thing to take account of. And obviously, again, rather like with race and ethnicity, we have to be a little bit careful in saying that, you know, to a certain extent, everybody has the right to say, I am going to have a family. But there's also the other position, which is to say, there's also something quite interesting and wonderful in deciding not to have a family. And once you realize that your blood and your resonance is safely tucked away in this kind of spiritual fabric of the world itself, you don't have to worry in the old way about not passing on your wisdom, because there's many different ways that can happen. So I think one of the techniques that empire uses is to encourage reproduction unmindfully. Now, mindful reproduction, when two wonderful people come together who've achieved balance and serenity and strength and wisdom and well-being and all that good stuff, say, hey, you know what? We've decided to have a baby. It's like the most brilliant thing in the world. It's magical. It's brilliant. That's very rare, though. I've seen that maybe five times in 42 years of life. Mm. I've seen that less than half a dozen times.
Yeah.
Most people I know who have decided to have a family don't have any of those things. They're imbalanced. They're ignorant. They're nice. A lot of these people are nice people, but they're generating tremendous problems by passing on this pain and ignorance over and over and over again. And I personally, I can't speak for anyone else, but for me, if I decided to have a family, I'm getting a bit long in the tooth for it now, but if I decided to have a family, I'd take a serious look at my own state of being and the state of being of my partner and our life and our trajectory and the state of the world and the community and everything. And I would take many, many special factors into account before I would even consider doing anything like that.
Well, but see, that's evil because that's eugenics. That's planning. You're right. No, but I mean, what we have today is obviously dysgenics, if you want to be harsh about it. You know, because I agree with you. It's very much about, see, the empire is seeking slaves, right? And it's seeking also, as you, I would agree
fuel,
with you there,
yeah.
Fuel, exactly. In the extension to that. And it's very much about quantity as opposed to quality, I reckon. And that's why they're very content with that. And the economic system in itself is, of course, constantly talking about there has to be growth. You know, someone has to be paying for all these, you know, social security bills by the time this generation gets old enough. So that means they have to have more and more and more and more people all the time. And that, as we know, is not sustainable. It doesn't work in the long run.
No.
But that's the a lot of the immigration policies is based on those premises, you know?
Yeah, nothing in the world is meant to continue growing. Nothing in the organic, natural world continues in its current form in the same way. What we do have is transformation. And that's where a form transcends its initial form and becomes something else, right? So that is an evolutionary process, or in some esoteric circles, an involutionary process, which is very interesting and very worthwhile of our study. What capitalism tries to do, which again is just the other arm of socialism and the same thing, is it says everything must have growth. And even where there isn't any, we have this ridiculous thing called negative growth, right?
Yeah.
And I was listening to a show the other day on the radio, which is a show that I think it comes on every Sunday, and it's a finance show. And they were talking about Bitcoin, which I'm kind of interested in. So I thought, oh, I'll check that out for a minute, you know, driving along with my coffee or whatever. And it was not very interesting. And this guy was talking about economics and growth as if it was the most pivotal part of human achievement, as if it was the pinnacle of what we can do as human beings is growth. And I just thought, it reminded me, I recently had a visitor, a friend from England, spend a couple of weeks with me. And we went to a marvelous forestry centre over here on the coast, the Tillamook Forest Centre, well worth a visit if anyone goes there. A beautiful building that they've put together. And it has a little film in there where you can see different forest fires, how it's affected, you know, hundreds of miles of this county over the years. And although the forest fire is a very dramatic event, and it has an impact on people's lives and obviously the lives of all the wonderful animals that also share this land with us, it's an essential part of the long-term health of the forest, because only when you have a forest fire do you get new growth, and you get certain terrains and certain types of wood and certain types of habitat that provide different opportunities for everybody, humans included. And so as time's gone by, rather than in the 30s and 40s when they just viewed forest fires as an unmitigated disaster, they see this frequent cataclysm as part of a natural cycle. And that again linked to another thought in my head, which was back to our old friend Immanuel Velikovsky, who in his book Worlds in Collision is essentially saying cataclysm, the earth basically almost destroying itself every few thousand years, is part of its evolutionary process. And it's as much a part of it as brushing our teeth is every day for us. It's absolutely the most normal, non-worrying thing in the world. And that is one of the elements why some people sometimes accuse me of not taking empire seriously enough and being a bit frivolous about it. And I say, well, I'll tell you this, in the most ancient wisdom that I can lay my hands upon, which is in the words of men, it's never on a page, it's never written down, in the words of fine men who I've had the privilege to meet, who are some of whom are still with us, they have said to me that the negative forces are always here to sustain certain imperatives in the world, and they impel growth in a very funny way, but they can never go beyond a certain threshold because of the earth changes. So with the frequent cataclysms and disasters, glorious that they are, that come to this planet, there's only a very short amount of time, you know, sort of geologically speaking, if you might, that anyone can ever seize control, and it's all completely neutralized after that. And my sense is, and again, another occasion to be vigilant in our language, that another great earth change is just starting to come now. And one of the other little naughtinesses of Empire is that they're going to try and make us think that they're doing it, and they're not. It's totally natural and completely outside of control of anybody, anybody at all, anything at all. And so I see that all related together. So when I look at 7 billion on the planet, it doesn't really worry me too much, because I know that that's been artificially inflated, because that ignorance and pain and that reproduction is necessary for the fuel source. But just like anything else, it's finite, right? And it's finite not only in terms of its physical resource, but also in terms of the time frame, because it, not too long in the future, that's all going to totally change. And it is part of human history that the very wisest and best things that we can come up with collectively are thrown into that Akashic, you know, record, into that soul and heart, into the sun, into the surrounding forces that interpenetrate this beautiful planet, and are safe. And all the little entities and avatars that scurry about doing that work get wiped out on a regular basis, exactly as it has to be and exactly as it is beautifully perfect for it to be. And I see that coming very shortly. And the difference is, 20 years ago, that would have filled me with trepidation. And now it fills me with joy, I have to tell you. Mm-hmm. And not just to get the annoyance of some of the stupidness out of the way, but also to bring us to that next evolutionary phase, because with each earth change, with each cataclysm, comes a jump in consciousness. So it's not a load of, you know, people holding hands on a summit somewhere, singing prayers or whatever. They can do that if they like. It's something very physical, and it's something that is propelled through the galaxy in every system, in every star system. And when it comes here, it purifies the planet. So when you look in some of the old European texts, you come across this word purification a lot, which since the Christianization of Europe takes on rather negative connotations. But if you go back prior to that, purification meant take the best bits and burn off the rubbish. And that is what happens, believe me, to this planet on a regular basis. So it's very difficult for me to get disenchanted beyond a certain level, because I know that as well as the really stupid things that are happening and all the daft people, I was just listening to Al Gore talk the other day, I nearly vomited blood onto the windshield listening to how awful he is and what a rubbish speaker he is as well, yeah, considering the experience he's had. All those funny people who are out there doing all that daft stuff and telling lies and deceiving good men and women only have a very short amount of time to do that. And I know that on the other hand, some of the very best wisdom and purest reflections of human excellence have arisen literally in the last few years to a level that is breathtaking. And to see such marvelous achievements and to see some of the old stories about World War One and World War Two finally getting a decent, fair treatment is very, very encouraging.
It is.
It's taken hundreds of years for some of the old histories to reveal themselves. So to see that accelerate makes me realize that when we get this evolutionary consciousness to really coalesce and really reach that flashpoint of wonderfulness, that indicates a temporal compression. Time speeds up and everyone can feel it, not just those who are getting, you know, beyond 30 or beyond 50 or whatever, even the young people can feel a temporal displacement of sorts, which if you go back and look at some of the old texts, is usually a precursor to an upgrade. So I just have a very positive view about even the most seemingly inexplicable problems. I think, well, we've learned some fascinating things from that. And the entities who have been like feeding off us, you know, like those, some of those fish that stick onto whales or a parasite in the intestine or something, they can't really survive after an earth change. They always get zapped. We just have to prepare ourselves now to self-govern and to self-determine spiritually, intellectually, morally. At the moment, if empire was just evaporated overnight, we'd be in a right mess because people are pig shit thick on this planet and they've no idea what to do. So we have to start to prepare now for what's going to come afterwards, which is how do we do this better without any external authorities? How do we properly and sustainably and wisely govern ourselves? And guess what? We go to history to get some of the lessons in that, not to the institutions and the universities, of course, but to ancient history to see other precedents for successful communities, large and small. And it does require a smallish number of people. You can't do it with 10 billion people. That's silly. It does require a very small number of people. And I don't think we need to worry too much about, you know, the Georgia Guidestones and all that nonsense, because it's always a very natural thing, you know? And I also think, speaking esoterically again for a minute, that there are forces which I've had recent encounters with personally who don't let fragmentation go beyond a certain point. So in certain esoteric circles, particularly in Western traditions, in Hermeticism, which came to Germany and Norway, of all places, and Britain, there is a division between wholeness and fragmentation, and the threshold is always guarded. So it can never go too far one way or the other. So I know that certain things cannot happen, which lots of, you know, conspiracy people worry themselves sick about in the forums. And, you know, I'm just waiting, like, it's always October, November, December, all the sort of doomsday things pile up. We've done quite well this year. There's not been very many. I remember in 2011, 12 and 13, there were millions of them. But I never worry about any of that stuff because I know that the natural system, the solar system, always creates a certain equilibrium of wholeness, which can never, ever be contravened. So I just can't help but be optimistic about all this.
Well, yeah, I definitely understand your perspective on that. I mean, it's to a certain extent, it's although it's more worrying to take a long-term cycle because of the reasons you said, because it's so fundamentally, when you realize the cycles of cleansing, whatever you want to call it, you know, yeah, purging, you there is a kind of a comfort in that. And then at the same time, even if you take it into account of that the empire itself is going through a kind of a collapse.
Absolutely. Yeah.
I think you can kind of view it in many different ways, that meaning that, you know, once the infrastructure is kind of gone, once the crutches is fallen out and just chaos within the system, you have to have something in place where you can actually, you and the people around you can survive. I think it's, I mean, even the preppers in America, they know about this stuff, right? And
they're
kind
yeah.
of clinging on to that idea a little bit. I go back and forth on it all the time because part of me is like, well, you know, we have to, I guess it's a multi kind of faceted approach to it. You have to try to do what you can within, you know, with the cards that we've been dealt here and try to improve things, try to do the best you can. And then at the same time, you have to think about the long-term cycles as well. Okay, what do we do? What direction do we move here to actually yep. ensure survival, right? So there's many different things you have to do, you know?
We do, yeah. I say worry about the things that you can control and that you have mastery over. So let's say, for example, that some you know, little extraterrestrial observer came down and said, right, you two guys, Henrik Palmgren and Neil Kramer and your friends and colleagues associated with you, we're going to make you responsible for this new, wonderful, mystical college of alternative and true, historical, modern, contemporary education. Would you be interested in doing that? I'd say, I think I would, and I think you'd probably agree. And in that case, we would then have to consider, okay, so what do we teach 7-year-olds and 25-year-olds and 55-year-olds? You do have to focus in on what it means to do this properly. And I think that's part of the solution. As I said right at the beginning of the first hour, some people come here and think, what a mess this is. I wish I lived in a different age. I never think that. I think this is really fascinating because you're getting this, as I say, this ultra tactical spiritual training when you come here. But secondly, not only do you speed up the dissolution of empire, but you get to sow the seeds of what comes next. So we get to take some unique observations that have never, ever been had before. And it is my view that people like me and you and Lana and all those wonderful people, each of us has a unique observation, a unique perceptive capacity. And let's say there's 100,000 people who compose a network of lucid beings, right? Listeners and me and you and colleagues and loads of other interesting people have all reached through their own efforts a certain level of attainment and cohesion in the thought and truth and authenticity in the heart. And each of us can see one piece of the puzzle. And each of us has the capacity to resolve one piece of the puzzle. And then when we all die and go back into the other space, into our home worlds and into our other realms, we take back what we've learned. And when you piece it together, you think, right, that's it. That's all that's necessary, right? Earth change, off we go. And I think that there's never been a time in as far back in history as I can possibly go in my own studies, both formally and informally, that there's been so many lucid souls here with such incredible valiance and authenticity. I've never seen that before. So it is a long game in the end, which is we're sowing seeds for something awesome that's coming, and we're examining the problem so this never happens again, which I don't think it need to. And it's not unique to Earth. So if we resolve it here, we can resolve it elsewhere, which is just to own that consciousness and to keep the frequency of it, metaphorically speaking, high, right? And once that's been determined, you can go off we go and we leave. And I don't think there's anything to be concerned about in that. And in my own personal life, any sort of legacy that I leave is not in the pride in my work or books or lectures or whatever, but is in the educational inspiration that I bring about in young people. That's all I care about these days, right? So when I did my sort of annual workshop in Portland at the Monaco Hotel, you know, it was full, it was a sellout, it was brilliant. The most lovely thing was that there were young people there, Henrik, who were like 22. There was like a 19-year-old guy there. Mm-hmm. And he sat there with his notebook making loads of notes. And these two girls coming down from Seattle or whatever, you know, with like green hair and loads of punk things on. And they're all very groovy. It could have been my daughter, you know what I mean? I felt really old. But honestly, it was so inspirational to see these fantastic people here who are young. It was saying, right, these are the people who are going to bridge between what's happening now and what's coming next. And now we're in our 30s and 40s. We'll soon be in our 60s and 70s before you know it. And we'll be in the privileged position, if we keep our hand good and if we keep our skills sharp, of being the next wise elders. So traditionally speaking, at the age of 63 in the old days is where you moved into your wise elderhood, right? So the years prior to that are to get your game straight, to get your shit together, basically, so you're fit to teach. So in times gone by, you were not even allowed to open your mouth until you were 35. So me and you would have been in a lot of trouble, wouldn't we, in earlier days gone by?
Yeah, because I wish I would have kept my mouth shut too. So. But, yeah. There you go.
Oh, thank God you didn't. But it's a symbol to say that until you've walked it and sweat it and bled it and cried it and laughed it, you're not fit to even call yourself an educator in any way, shape or form. And I totally agree with that. And I look at me at 32 and 22 and 12 and think, you know, you knew nothing, but you did the best that you could. And so I see this very much as a matter of, there is a time where in this transitional phase, you have to keep your nerve basically. And you have to understand that empire has played a role in the disavowal of the human journey, partly from ourselves. I personally think most of it's our own fault, personally. But I do know that there are outside forces that are exploiting that. So to be involved in even the very smallest way in doing something to change that situation, I think is the best thing you could possibly do. And some people write books, some people teach, some people make music, some people paint pictures. However you choose to involve yourself in that, it doesn't matter. But to sow that seed of transformation is the best and most powerful thing you can do, because it has a tremendous physical effect on everything around you. So I just try and encourage that wherever I go, and just encourage people to get involved in their own unique skills in that regard.
Now, on the road of getting there as a way to, you know, I think it's a good exercise nonetheless, but we're basically talking about independence here, being able to live your life the way you want to. And with that, it does take, to a certain extent, it takes geography. It takes those people of like mind, the community, to be somewhere physically on the earth. We have this great thing with the internet now, which is fantastic, obviously. But nonetheless, I think there's a real itch and an urge for getting more and more of those people together, you know, literally somewhere on the earth. And I think on the road to getting there, we have seen some interesting things like, you know, kind of secession type things, you know, breaking up from the European Union nonetheless, but even like the Scottish independence vote,
Catalonia,
Brittany in France, even the Basque people, of course, tried for a long time. But I'm seeing more of that down the road as well coming, things of really trying to, well, create true diversity, if you will, of politics and of community, if you will, you know?
Yeah, I said earlier, I think that the empire is over. And I think what we're witnessing is the end game. We've won and we don't know we've won. And what we're seeing, somebody said it to me in this way the other day, is imagine a school bully, a really terrible child who has gone to the headmaster's office or the principal or whatever you call it, and they've been expelled. And that's it, right? You're out of here. Don't come back. I've told your mum and dad, get out. And on the way out of the door, the school bully punches a hole through the door because they're so pissed off. That's what's happening now. The game is over, and that has already taken place. And it's really very, very difficult now for Empire to ramp up things, because even the, you know, despite some of the craziness of America, as you well know now, despite that, there are lots of things there that are amazing, which is a lot of the law enforcement people are good men, which I've never seen that in numbers before. And they're refusing in many places to enforce federal policies which are unconstitutional, which is very exciting to me. And I'm not talking about a few guys in big cities going for an office. I'm on about regular cops or whatever, and firemen and military people and all kinds of stuff who are saying, no, we are here to do a community service for people. We're not here to bring in unconstitutional federal law. And that's to me is very exciting. And I've seen some incredible, real old school sheriffs who uphold that, which is very, very interesting to me.
Yeah.
But even as you say in Catalonia, you know, Spain's got a big problem on its hands now. That region of Catalonia is, as you say, is wanting independence. And if I'm not mistaken, it's made up of these four provinces, including Barcelona and Girona and stuff. And so, of course, you know, Spain, being a good old conduit of empire, tried to block this Catalan vote. Millions of people who desire independence and wish to express that. And the central government of Spain made that as very hard as possible. So they said, it's not even an official vote. If you do this, it means nothing. But still, the vote went ahead. And the top guy of their regional administration, Artur Mas, said 80% of voters want independence. And they had a 40% turnout, which is very rare for a non-electoral process. And all the Catalans want is to build a better way of living that the central authorities in Spain are incapable of. And they want to celebrate their heritage and culture, their real heritage and culture.
Yeah.
And they want to look after their own economy. They say, we do not want anything to do with this horror of European centralization.
Yeah.
We can do better with small, sustainable, well-managed, locally empowered communities rather than being part of this sprawling, you know, conglomeration or whatever. All they want to do is have the right to self-determination. And every single person on this planet has that. Nobody has the right to tell you you cannot self-determine. So for empire, this is a massive problem, because to have little bits of countries breaking off and doing their own thing is a disaster. And they can't allow that to happen. It's possibly the most important thing for imperial cultures to keep it all together, and they can't. It's starting to break away. So that's a novel thing to me.
Well, I agree. That would tighten their economics, and they obviously want to try to have as much as possible to just funnel all those funds into a central point like the European Union. But I mean, think about it. It's insanity. I mean, it's amazing to me that some countries as large as they are, America in particular, but many other too, that it's been going for such a long time, meaning that this huge entity, a centralized government, is supposed to know what people need in literally, in some cases, different parts of a continent, from New York to, you know, San Diego, what have you.
Hawaii, yeah.
Well, exactly. You know, it's unreal, really, because everything has been very much about getting it as you want it, right? Very much about individualism, although it's been a kind of a faux one that we've been getting, but it's it's there as a reflection of it. And I think that we're moving more and more in that direction. And why not, you know?
It is. And the thing that I've learned coming to America, having been here, you know, a number of years now, is that it really is 50 different countries. Each state is totally different from the other ones. And I have done a couple of interviews with different people or whatever, and we've talked about the Second Amendment and guns and stuff, and people get very excited and upset about that. And it's just interesting to me that you can get such a huge difference from one place to another. So, you know, many people who'd consider themselves progressive Democrats and whatnot feel that by restricting the tools that violent people use, they'll reduce the aggressive influence of that individual, which is stupid.
Yeah.
And they also believe that when such restrictions are, you know, put across the board, across the country, they'll reduce violence as a whole. And that's very false thinking.
Yeah.
And particularly in California and New York and New Jersey and Massachusetts and Connecticut, that they are unashamedly dismantling that Second Amendment, you know, on the Bill of Rights, and denying people the right to defend themselves by bearing arms. And California is the worst of all. And in California, there's no explicit provision in their bizarre state constitution to guarantee the individual to bear arms. It's just blatantly, for here, unconstitutional. It's super stupid, like what was happening in Britain in the 90s. You know, it's like, it just doesn't work. The positive to that, again, is that a lot of Californian law enforcement officials are saying, you know what, this is wrong, I'm not going to enforce that law. So you've got actual guys on the street, men and women, young and old, saying, I'm not enforcing that law, and I've been a law enforcement official for 30 years, I'm not doing that. It's wrong. And so not only have they got a problem with state-sized sovereign cessation, they've also got something more interesting to me, which is mass individuals distributed all over the place who are saying, I'm not going to do that law. So lots of people are not taking part in Obamacare. Lots of people are not going to pay property taxes in Portland, which have got absolutely nothing to do with taxing property. It's failures in corrupt local government. And they're not doing it. And these are like nice people. They're not just the people with the dreadlocks and the you know, the pierced eyelids or whatever.
Right.
I'm talking about people who are just like in a shirt and tie with short hair and, you know, brown shoes on. Even they're starting to think, you know what, this is just wrong. I'm not going to do that. So that's what I mean about that critical mass. You can't just send in NATO forces and crush everybody. You can't nuke it. That won't happen. That won't be allowed, as I've said, of those forces that guard the threshold. You have to have consent, and people are gradually beginning to withdraw that consent. And in the sort of sovereign law business, it's called creating pathways of exemption. So if you want to go and do something that is illegal, instead of behaving unlawfully, you go and create a pathway of exemption for yourself and get that ratified by the local authorities. So there's all sorts of clever ways of doing this, like people who've created their own driving license and had the authorities say, yeah, well, I don't know, it's very unorthodox, but okay. Hmm. Or people who wanted a concealed carry permit who said, well, this is just for me and I've created all the legal documentation and there you go. And the sheriff looks at it and goes, well, this is very unorthodox, but okay. And that's a pathway of exemption where you create your own honorable laws with sensible parameters on them that are yours, not the system's. So all these exemptions are starting to propagate through the system. And I know the empire cannot keep a lid on it for much longer. And it goes into every realm, you know?
Yeah, exactly. It does. I hope we're going to see more and more of this in the years to come now. And something has to give, right? It can't just carry on as it does either. It's an economy thing that's just completely going to fail, or it's a political thing. You know, it can come from any angle, basically. And people just have to be ready, as you said before. It has to be something which you already have to have certain things in place so that you know that, all right, if shit goes down, you better know what to do about it, right? Yeah. Right.
Well, can I quote you on that?
Sure.
I'm going to get a t-shirt printed up with that. Henry Pinewood says, if shit goes down, you better know what to do. Yeah, and that knowing what to do is an attitude, which is don't be afraid of thinking that the economy is going to go down or the healthcare system is going to collapse or the grid is going to go off or some meteorites. Don't ever, ever be afraid of any of that, because this system has to come to its flashpoint. And that's part of an evolutionary process, which is not the system collapsing in chaos. It's part of the solar system, which completely transcends all imperial machinations and agents and origins completely and utterly. It's the solar system saying, okay, guys, you've done some awesome things. There's some bizarre things. And now we're going to do the Earth change dance all over again. Are you ready for it? And all we have to do is say, yep, we sure are. Bring it on. And that kind of attitude makes the difference between those who perish and disintegrate and those who go on. And that is totally self-determined by your own attainment and attitude. So whether you live or die is a slightly different question. But the furtherance of your soul journey and your soul wisdom is completely in your hands. And nobody can do anything to change that. So there is a fearlessness required here and an attitude to say, we're going to build communities, generate wisdom and well-being, be creative. We're going to dissolve things that don't work and we're just going to carry on with that and nobody's going to stop that. And as greater things arise in the world that are, as I say, beyond us and beyond empire, they are natural forces that come through that giant big yellow disc in the sky. And that is our friend, believe me.
Yeah, there's a lot of obviously things, tangents and everything we could go from here. But I think the main, you know, basic thing that we've been talking about here is basically, move towards independence, individual preference and selection and our own choice, basically doing what we want to do and living in the capacity that we do want to live. And then, of course, on top of that, we see that the structure of control and the system as such is trying to everything it can basically to prevent that. At one level, it's trying to cater to us and say, here, look at this. This is all you need kind of thing. And then at the same time, if you do want to break away from that, that won't fly, you know, kind of thing. But is there anything big that we've kind of left out? Do you think that we should cover or address here before we begin to wrap things up for this time, Neil?
Yeah, I'd just say, just as an extension to what you were saying, because you just highlighted an interesting point. When you go on this journey of spiritual development and independence, which to me are synonymous with each other, it does involve movement, and it will come to a point in anybody's life when they reach a certain threshold of attainment and of self-expression where it will compel them to move, physically move from where they are. And you might say, well, that's easy for you to say. It was not easy for me to come here. It was kind of difficult, but it was exactly what I had to do. And it was the right thing to do. And I've noticed across my client base of all the wonderful men and women who I talk to on a regular basis about spiritual development matters, it's the same with them as well. And it has been for years and years. So spiritual development brings about movement. And in these transitional times, it is good to just be careful about how you put your roots. They have an old saying in my tradition, which is your roots are not in the ground, they're in the sky, right? Mm-hmm. And when that's the case, you can appreciate the land and you can have this intimate union with it and this sacred communion with it. But you can also say to yourself, it is my business and it is my destiny to move around this planet and to see other things and to go to other places and not where I expected, sometimes wonderful new places that I couldn't even imagine how I could do it. And you get drawn to these things. So I think movement in times of transition really sort of rewards those who keep their life as flexible as possible. Don't invest in things that you don't believe in. Keep your life as simplistic and light and fluid as you possibly can. Because when the universe whispers in your ear or it beckons you to a new terrain, then you can follow it. Then you can go with the adventure. Whereas if you've stuck yourself deep in the concrete somewhere, you miss it and you miss opportunity after opportunity. So always my advice to people is responsibility and commitment are only ever really psychological. In terms of what you do in the system, keep it as light and fluid as you possibly can. And in these transitional days, that will you'll really notice a difference if you can do that, because then you can move with that natural trajectory of your own growth, because your growth is very closely related to the growth of this solar system. And when you're both doing it together, you get this extra support from the cradle of the world. It sees you, it acknowledges you, it knows what you're doing. And from our perspective, we get all these lucky coincidences and synchronicities and happenings and support. And that's a sign that you're doing it right.
Now, obviously, what that is, that transformation, what have you, I think it will mean very different things to different people as well, and how that kind of plays out in their own life here. But let me just mention one other point here before we wrap up.
Please
do. I want to get your take on that as well, because it's about independence and, you know, living your life how you want to and all that. And we forget sometimes as well that we do need our people, our tribe. You know, in the West, we hold individualism very highly, but I don't think we should be afraid of camaraderie and having people around us as well. There are different tribes, of course, and different people everywhere. And I appreciate, you know, the type of individualism that the West has brought. It makes us unique, but at the same time, it can create, I think we've seen this in Europe and other countries now too, a kind of a hyper individualism where it kind of goes out of control, and we have a difficulty getting together and doing stuff, you know, gathering your people around you and making shit happen, you know?
Yeah, you have to gather physically. Last time we spoke, I talked about this thing called The Core, which was this like online community. What I intended to do with that was have an online community of people. And then halfway through the exercise, I thought, you know what? I'm not going to do that. I'm going to do something different. So for the last year, I've been transforming that into what it has to be for me, which is a physical meeting place. And so groups are now coming together. And it's a physical thing. And I'll tell you, it couldn't be more important. We should have talked about this right at the start, but thank you for bringing it up. Gathering together physically is critical for this whole exercise of personal and tribal growth and understanding and education and for the dissolution of empire. You have to get together. You can't just do it on the computer. You have to physically meet each other and spend time with each other. And that's another very important reason why movement and flexibility and sort of being agile with your resources, however great or small they are, make them work for you, right? So getting together with my kinsmen, my fellows, male and female, is absolutely essential in my life. And I make sure that I make that happen. And it's not a nice to have, and it's not just socializing, just having wine and cigars or whatever, although that occurs very often as well. Yeah. But it's actually the real dynamic that's created in the group cannot be simulated or substituted by individualism or by self-indulgence. There's a time for the sanctuary of being on your own in that serene contemplative space, yes. There's a time for movement and exploration and travel, yes. And there is a time for the exchange and the bonding that only takes place with physical gatherings. Those three things, self, world, and tribe, have to come together if you're going to get things manifesting in the way you want them to. You can't just do it on your own, on a computer, in forums, or even writing 50 books a year and being some great scholar. You've got to get out there. You've got to get your fingernails dirty, be with people, and learn from the social protocols that you have to develop in conversation, live, in the flesh, spontaneously, touching each other, smelling each other, smiling at each other, see the eyes of the person, right? It sounds dead simple, this, but I can't tell you how pivotal that is for the acceleration and deepening of our growth. That has to happen. I'm so glad you mentioned that. Thank you.
Oh, you bet. Well, exactly. It's an easy thing to forget, and you do tend to get kind of isolated in front of the screen when you're busy.
You just overlook this and think, "Hey, we must get together." No, it's crucial. It's critical. It's part of your obligation to your growth of yourself and your wider tribe. It absolutely is right up there.
Well, thank you, Neil. Great talking with you again, touching base with the work you've been doing and hearing more about what area you've been developing in and everything else. Tell us a little bit more about some of the things you have on the website. I know the Alchemy of Will, I think, is the latest feature you have available there, right?
Yeah, there's a great workshop that I did, Alchemy of Will, that was a really excellent event, and that can be completely downloaded. And it's 2 days of discussion, of workshop on all the subjects that we've been talking about to do with mysticism and esotericism and empire and all these interrelated things. Unfoldment, Secrets and Sinks is on there, which is the previous workshop, all totally novel. Nothing is ever repeated. It's always completely original, new stuff. My book, The Unfoldment, is on there. The Audio Cleaver from way back, which is great introductory material for people who are just starting to look at empire. I have a new workshop that's going to be coming out in the next couple of months called Esoteric Roots, which is a recording of a live event just from a couple of months ago. And there's some, as I say, there's some exciting new film projects that I've been working on for a year now, which will start to surface in 2015, and also some interesting events that will be taking place in 2015 on the East and West Coast. So all of that will be listed on my webpage, and there's links to my Facebook sort of community page on there, and you can find out all the details. So that's neilcramer.com.
Right, very good. Well, I'm glad we were able to touch upon some of these topics today, Neil. Tribe and tradition and race and ethnicity and culture and the importance of these things as a way to kind of also explain to people, from different perspectives all the time of why these things are important and why we need to address them and why they're part of our makeup and why nature itself created things in this manner. It's not us for to meddle with. So I really appreciate that, Neil. Thanks again, and keep up the good work.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
Also, by the way, don't forget to check out our archives. There's a lot for you there. Also, take a peek at the latest Insight episodes for more on this. Thanks again for being a member and for your interests in these important topics. We'll be back in just a few with Lawrence Eastman, the people versus the banks, and also the Russell Brand debate fallout that occurred. Some interesting stuff with Lawrence is coming up. Also, Carlos Morales, a Child Protective Services agent, speaking out about the corruption within the agency. Then later we have Anthony Michels as well from Holland. All right, have a great day or evening wherever you are, and we will talk more soon. Take care.